Let me explain to you the guest that we have lined up for today, Dom Flemons. You know Dom, even if you don't think you do. Dom was a founder of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and he now has another solo project out called Prospect Hill. It will be coming out on July 22nd. It's not the first solo project that Dom has put out as the American Songster. I met Dom last year at the in the middle of the Gray Fox Bluegrass Festival. He was performing them with the Carolina Chocolate Drops. We talked for a while in the merchandise tent, which was right next to my broadcast booth, and I ran over and caught him, and we talked, and we could never hook up together. Well, what he was doing was working on this new album, Prospect Hill, as the American Songster, and he's put together a wonderful album. So when it was ready to be announced to be released, we hooked up again and said, okay, let's do this now. And I said, it's great, Dom. So it's recorded. We did it because of the scheduling. And we go through everything. Dom is a fascinating guy, has a wonderful sense of music and musical history. Beyond all that, he's a fabulous musician, plays so many different instruments so well, and reinterprets old-time music is the best way to describe it. But he doesn't mimic it. He just gets the feel of it and replays it back to you. The new album is actually sort of designed as a vinyl front side and a back side. He will talk about that. He will talk about the transitioning points of the album and the type of music that he's incorporating into it. It's absolutely cool interview. I really enjoyed talking to Dom. I'm going to meet him in person again this coming Friday up in Walton, Kentucky. This program geographically comes to you from northern Kentucky, across the river from Cincinnati. Walton, Kentucky, home of Steve Koth and Triple Crown winner. It's about a half hour down the road from me. So I will catch up to Dom there, and we'll fill out a little more information for my personal tastes. But you're going to hear Dom at the bottom of this hour. It's 2 o'clock Eastern now. Wherever you are, just do the math yourself. In about half an hour or so, we're going to begin a 50-minute-plus interview with Dom Flemons. We cover a lot of ground. And Dom's a fascinating guy. He's got a lot to talk about, and I enjoyed every second of it. And you're going to understand his motivations behind this album, what he's doing and what he's thinking, and how he's performing, and just all that goes into it. Really a lot going on with Dom Flemons. You're going to enjoy that. All right, well, I'm very happy to have today on Unreal Bluegrass, big fan of every musical thing that I've seen Dom Flemons do. And Dom, we finally hook up, man. It only took like a year.
Oh, I'm sorry, what? sorry, there's helicopters and trains all came by.
Oh, I don't know. Okay, then I don't know what you're doing there, but if you have to leave in a hurry because of helicopters and trains, you don't bother saying goodbye, just get out.
Oh, no, it just happened to come by all at the same time, right as you were introing.
All right.
Let's start over again.
Well, I'll get it started. All right. I'm going to welcome to the show again. I'm not restarting the tape, man. That's just live, okay? We're just leaving that there. So, Dom Flemons, who I'm a big fan of from the Carolina Chocolate Drops and then solo stuff that you're doing, and I was just mentioning that we've been trying to hook up to get together on Unreal Bluegrass for almost a year now. It works now really well, and I'm happy to welcome Dom Flemons. How you doing, man?
Oh, I'm doing all right. Yeah, I'm glad that we could finally get together, because when you first emailed me, you know, it was when I was still talking about working on my new album, Prospect Hill, and I'm glad that now that the album's finished and coming out, that we could get a chance to talk a little.
It's perfect. It's perfect timing, and I mentioned to you off the air that I know that you're coming. You probably haven't looked this far ahead, but you're going to be... I'm in northern Kentucky, just south of Cincinnati. Now, the program is internet, so it's worldwide and shoots out into the space. But physical, geographically, I am south of Cincinnati, Ohio, which also like 30 minutes from where you're going to be on the 27th. You're going to be in Walton, Kentucky, at a place called Stevenson's Tavern and Grill. Okay, just trust me on that one. I've looked far enough ahead. So you're going to be coming to town. So that kind of works out good timing all the way around. I've got the new album. I got a version of that in an email, Prospect Hill. And for anyone who doesn't know who Carolina Chocolate Drops are, shame on you. Dom was one of the original founding members of that band, that's just done everything great, bringing music back and all kinds of other... You explore so many different things. If you've ever seen the Chocolate Drops perform, the performance is phenomenal, and the lessons and the history and the context is just riveting to me. I absolutely love it. I know that you do the same thing now with this album, because I've heard enough of it and seen your things. So right now, are you touring alone, Dom?
Well, you know, it's kind of been interesting. The first half of this year, I haven't been doing a whole bunch of far touring in terms of, like, going out and doing a lot of dates like I've done in previous years. Like, I just needed some time to relax and, you know, give myself a little space so that I could, one, record my new record, and then, two, you know, I'm realistic in it, and in that when I went out to, I knew when I made the decision to go solo, I knew no matter how much acclaim I've gotten in the Carolina Chocolate Drops, I knew that I'm going to be a brand new act to most people. So just really trying to craft the behind-the-scenes stuff, and that includes making great, unique material that we have on the website, making sure, you know, like when we hired our publicist that's doing the album, and, you know, kind of the stuff beside recording that we did in the Carolina Chocolate Drops a whole bunch, really trying to get the right amount of media and letting people be aware that, especially for me, you know, like, you know, some people would recognize me from the group, but by my own name, they wouldn't particularly recognize me, but really trying to make a point to show that I'm not just, you know, I'm not like a 20-year-old kid coming off the block, but I've been playing music professionally for about 10 years, and that, you know, I've done a lot of great work, and this is just an extension of that work, and I'm ready to just keep on going and getting good music out there wherever I can.
Obviously, Dom, if you're by yourself, and I know you tour a little bit with, I've seen connections with Pokey Lafarge, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But when you're by yourself, though, all of a sudden you go from, and I want to talk about the resources that you use. I know that you're very much into, you know, exploring the old time music and refining it and reinventing it. But when you go from such a dynamic stage show as the Carolina Chocolate Drops with there's so much activity and so much, you know, contribution to just being Dom Flemons there by himself, you have a lot of different instruments that you play, but how do you mind, what's your mindset about filling in the space by yourself as a solo artist?
Oh, well, for me, I just take on a lead role. In the Carolina Chocolate Drops, I had a lead role as a arranger and a musical director, but in terms of the singing, it was usually Justin in the original trio, but then Rhiannon were the main vocalists, and I arranged the tunes, and I played a lot of backups. So for me, I have a whole other repertoire of stuff that I did. I played solo before I joined the group, too, for about 6 years.
Right.
Not professionally, but I played out and developed a repertoire, played in bars and buffs. So, to me, playing solo is, like, really my bread, always been my bread and butter. So, to me, to play out solo, I don't think of it as a change, per se. I know how to bring all the excitement that I did in the Chocolate Drops to my own solo thing.
Okay.
And it's just, you know, I don't even think of it changing that much. I just don't play fiddle. That's the only thing. But I got a harmonica instead.
I was kidding you. We just, so folks know, that we've been trading messages since this possibility came up. And the new album, Prospect Hill, just so people know, you know, Dom is a multi-instrumentalist and really neat stuff that you're doing. And I've never heard you play harmonica. I've heard you play it before, but not the way you play it on this album. And I made a reference to a harmonica player that I think is the best, Sonny Terry. But you really have an edge to this harmonica playing that maybe didn't fit in with what you were doing in the group setting before. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I mean, you know, when you're in a string band, I mean, when you have the fiddle, unless you're specifically doing kind of double parts, which we never really did a whole bunch of in the Chocolate Drops, with the harmonica, I mean, the harmonica is just pretty much useless. I mean, unless it's, you know, because even in the older Chocolate Drops repertoire, it was either I'd be chugging out rhythm harmonica or I'd be playing the lead part. So most of the time when the fiddle comes out, the harmonica usually goes away. And so the harmonica and guitar were two of my first instruments. You know, I played drums growing up, and then when I got into folk music, I was into Bob Dylan, so I got into guitar and harmonica. So my skills on the harmonica, I've learned a few different styles, and I'm actually trading back and forth with another great harmonica player on the record, Guy Davis.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So he provides a harmonica on several tracks, like one of them, the title track, Marching Up Prospect Hill. Kind of an interesting story, just with having known Guy for a lot of years. He was trying to show me how to do Sonny Terry-style harmonica, because he had just been on the revival of Finnegan's Rainbow, or Finian's Rainbow on Broadway, and he had that really hot in his repertoire. So when we cut the record, I knew I wanted to do a piece where Guy was playing Sonny Terry-style, and then I would be playing Bones like J.C. Burris, who was Sonny Terry's nephew, and the two of them played together. And so Sonny Terry played harmonica, and J.C. Burris played the bones.
I did not know that was his nephew, so there, I'm learning something already. This is working out well. Okay, I get so go, keep going. Let me interrupt you, but go ahead.
And so so abstractly, like, you know, Guy's one of the few people who plays that style of harmonica, and I'm probably one of the only people who knows who J.C. Burris is enough that plays bones as well. So I wanted to really represent that on the track, and just do it with just, you know, it's like a minute and a half, I'd say.
Yeah.
You know, and with the record, that was what it was all about, was showing off a lot of different styles that I can play, either as a straight lead role or as an arranger and as a rhythm player, also the songwriter. I tried to do all these different ideas and show different styles while still trying to make it cohesive, you know, because that's
right.
The thing too is, like, you know, I have a fan base of the Carolina Chocolate Drops. I didn't want to turn them off, but I also didn't want to do something that was so similar to the Chocolate Drops that it was going to turn people off as well.
That's a great point, Dom, because when you listen to Prospect Hill, this new album, there are things that you could sneak into a recording with that group, but there's things that are electric. You have some electric sounds, and you have this other more, well, I'll just say a more edgy harmonica sound that wouldn't fit, but you do sort of like make the transition from that sound, still old-time music. And when I say I know you're some electric guitar work on here, it's not like a rock and roll guitar. It fits it within the time frame of where you're looking for the musical sound that inspires you, but it does move along. You are taking different turns on this album.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, this album, I really sat down, I crafted every aspect of it really thoroughly, just knowing that it was gonna, just knowing that there would have to be some response from it from the fans. I just, you know, and also I also wanted to just pull out stuff that I've had laying around. I mean, it's like the same as but I wanted to do the opposite of what someone like George Harrison did.
Right.
And put out an extremely long record. I wanted to pick a bunch of songs that I had known for years and ideas I'd had and make a short, concise record that was easy to get through so that people could listen to it. You know, it's like some of my favorite records are some of the ones made in the early 70s, like Moon Dance by Van Morrison or Monobone Jackin' by Cat Stevens. When you look at the time frame of these records, it's like 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And so I made this album exactly 39 minutes on the dot.
You know what's funny that you mentioned that, because I'm with you on that. Like 40 minutes, it was 10 or 12 minutes to a side, and you turn it over.
Yeah.
And it also allowed you, now because we have the technology available to make a CD that lasts 70 minutes, it's hard to really sit and get into 70 minutes of music. Well, you can do it with 20, and you got to get up and turn it over. So it's kind of neat that I never noticed that you did that on this, but yeah, you're writing that 20 minute per side if you think of flipping the vinyl over.
And I made it for vinyl too, for LP. So I mean, there's going to be the CD version available, but I mean, it's by the time you hear Sonoran Church two step, that's technically the end of side one, and Too Long I've Been Gone to begin of side two.
Oh, great.
And I try to keep those things in mind, because it's some of the stuff that I talk about a lot when I'm just talking with friends of mine. Because even an artist you like, 76 to 80 minutes of that artist. I mean, I love Tom Waits, but Tom Waits always fills up the CD.
Yeah, it's hard.
And it's hard. I mean, it's hard even for an artist that you really like to sit down and hear their vision for that length of time. you know, and especially, and you hit it on the head too with an LP, which there seems to be some interest growing. I think that it's only can go so far, because I think once people realize that when you have more than 10 of these, it's a pain in the ass to move. they're going to have the same problems they always did, but, you know, if new artists are putting LPs out, I think that that's something that people would really get into.
You know, it's funny, more and more are doing that on a limited number, but I had a woman, I told you before we got on the air, I have a jazz program in Cincinnati that's over the air, and I was interviewing a lady from Columbus, wonderful woman. I love what she's doing, and she's got a CD out, and she's got 150 LPs, because she recognizes the same thing you're talking about, that there's a limited audience, but there's a strong audience for it, if that's the way to describe
sure.
it, you know?
I got this theory. Well, I have a funny theory with it. Like, at least for the younger people, for the older people, it's like there's a nostalgia idea with records. You pull out your old records and you say, "All right, now I'm going to dust them off and listen to them." Or people are rabid collectors and they've always had them. But other ways, I find that little kids, I mean, like, I'm 31, and I grew up with a record player in the house, but people 5 to 10 years younger than me, that may not be the case. And I feel like the fascination with records will hit the younger people. You know, just some percentage of the younger people are going to be fascinated the same way that anybody who's ever been fascinated with records are.
Yeah, and because if for no other reason, they've never seen them.
You know, and big LP and the artwork. It's something that I can only hope that it'll happen, you know. And then the other thing is Year of the Folk Singer, which has been my big credo for 2014, which it came to me when I was in Australia earlier this year that I'd thought of it. I was like, man, this year's the Year of the Folk Singer. There's so much stuff happening in the community. And there's such a, I don't know, there seems to be a huge movement of people wanting to get into more acoustically based music or tradition or localized, whatever you want to call it. You know, specialized music. And then once Pete Seeger passed, that to me was the ultimate signifier that the folk music community is going to rise up again.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, you're right. It's like when he passed, which seemed like he never would, when he finally did, it's like, wait a minute, what do we have here, and what do we need to do to make sure that, you know, all that stuff that he did for all those years and for all the import that he had in what he was doing, not just entertaining, but the message that he conveyed. It's a good time to stop and take stock on a musician like you who's playing folk and old-time music. You know, what do we do now that Pete Seeger is gone?
Sure, because I mean, like, the idea of standards have even come up in the past year. You know, like the complete backlash to the movie Inside Llewyn Davis from the old guard.
Right.
I mean, I've been in this field for about a decade, and I've never seen such a gigantic response from anything that was folk music too. Compared to it being roots music or any of the other circumventing terms that we've made people don't go running for the hills thinking you're singing Kumbaya, you know. But the fact that they're marketing it as folk, I was like, wow, folk music, you know.
Yeah.
Dave Van Ronk got the most press he ever got. Paul Clayton had articles written about him. These are musicians that, you know, fans of Dylan may get into, but for the rest of the world, I mean, these are complete unknowns. But the fact that they have some press.
Yeah, they got their name out. Yeah,
you know. Then there's the Mumford thing, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Decemberists, that whole kind of heavy rock power ballad, acoustic music. You know, that's the whole thing. That's a controversy in the community. You know, I'm kind of indifferent to it, because, you know, I just hope that I can at least play my music, and that'll make its own statement compared to what those guys do.
Well, but Dom, you recognize this too, that the reaction is creating a positive influence. The reaction itself, you never want to have someone create a project like that movie or an album even that creates backlash. It's not the intent, but the kind of what's pulled along in the wake is a renewed interest in what the music should have been or could have been, or maybe what they're really talking about. It's the thesis, you know, it's that whole dynamic there where you synthesize something to where you're now back doing the real stuff that people can see. You know what I mean?
Also working with the Music Maker Relief Foundation, I found that's very interesting to see a lot written saying that there aren't any more traditional artists. There aren't any more artists that are from the South that have learned it from their generationally anymore. And for a company that it's all that they work with are those type of artists. And why aren't there venues for these artists?
Right.
Why aren't there venues for people, for solos, duos, and small ensembles? We've outgrown. It's almost like it's like music's almost outpriced itself, like New York, like Manhattan.
Yeah.
It's outpriced itself in terms of venues. Because now, like, if you're a solo, duo, or a small ensemble, you're anything less than a rock band, it's like, forget about it.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's a backlash to that, you know, people like Willie Watson are out there, Pokey Lafarge is out there.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple of Blind Boy Paxton, Frank Fairfield. I mean, the fact that these guys are getting some traction is just, I mean, you know, my group, the Caroline Chaga Drops, there's stuff that I do. I mean, it's like the fact that any of us are getting any traction, I mean, it's a very exciting time. But at the same time, it's very overwhelming. Who's the audience? It's like, no. People don't even know anymore who is the audience for anything. We all have our own choices in media, anyway.
Yeah, well,
that's a big tangent to that, but it's all kind of interrelated. When I worked on the record, I tried to figure out how to get the variety so that it wouldn't get boring for people, but at the same and made the tracks just, you know, concise enough to where, you know, you get the flavor, and it's a complete statement without it being overbearing, because I feel like there's so much of an aesthetic now for people to do little frillies and extra things in their songs, and it's like 5-minute songs when it should have been a 2.5-minute song, just long solos or ambiance or atmosphere, you know,
right.
Whatever it is.
Oh yeah, sure, I know.
You know, and I tried to really make a record that was just the opposite of that.
And
it was just like a nice record that you can just sit through and say, I enjoy the hell out of this.
Yeah.
And I wrote songs. I hope people enjoy the words. I mean, I got a degree in English, and I did performance poetry, so I've written for a long time. So I really tried to make sure the songs were of a quality that I hope people would like, and hopefully would even may want to sing. I don't know, you know?
You know, that.
I tried that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and you've done it because the songs are real. I'm going to use the word clean, and I don't mean that in a technical sense, but as you're describing it, you know, two to three minutes of you know, the musicianship is phenomenal. I mean, let's not let anyone think that you're doing a simple album because you want to keep within that context of simple music. In that sense, the musicianship is phenomenal, but the songs themselves are very clean and very accessible. Like you said, people could sing these and still appreciate the writing and the musicianship involved.
Yeah, and that also was a very important factor too. Like on a couple of the tracks, I have two fellows that I'm going to be playing with as my trio, Ben Hunter and Joe Siemens. But I didn't want to make a band centric record. I felt like really showcasing myself as a performer, and then let my album have a cast of characters around that. So there's two distinct sides to the record. Like, I didn't want to do an acoustic side and an electric side. I didn't even want to address that issue, because I feel like we're so past it. I feel like we're 60 years past that.
Right.
You know, if I use an electric guitar, I mean, whoop-de-doo. I mean,
right. They're not going to unplug you at Newport now.
Exactly. But at the same time, I didn't want to put so much electric that it would be, You know, sometimes I see, again, see, because I'm a record collector, I think about these things.
Right.
I see a lot of times a musician will want to part, and then they'll just put tons of electric guitar, tons of the opposite of what people are expecting on their record. And I tried to make sure when I had electric guitar, it was saying something.
Exactly.
You know, and I had two sides of it. I had Guy Davis and I had Joe and Ben on one part. And I had Pura Faye come in, sing a great, great vocal on, but they got it fixed right on. And then I had a second session where I had drums, Kobe Watkins, Keith Danz on the second guitar. He also played six-string banjo and a nylon string guitar on Too Long I've Been Gone. Had the bass player, Ron Grendel, and then also had Brian Horton playing all the horn parts, the sax, the soprano, tenor sax, and also clarinet.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was phenomenal to work with these guys. You know, like, I knew that I wanted to keep a folky sound, so for that half with Guy, you know, Guy's such a phenomenal player that he and I, you know, I had the arrangements, I showed him the Guy, I told him the feel I wanted, and then we practiced a little bit, had a rocking arrangement. But me and Guy were really on that same wavelength with how to handle a lot of the material. But I knew coming into it that I wanted to have some stuff where there was a bigger band sound with drums and bass and stuff. Like, I can't do it anymore.
Right.
Was my first thing I wanted to focus on. But then San Francisco Baby, we brought that into it. And then, you know, so we did another session where we had, like, San Francisco Baby, I did one with my trio. I may try to put that out later. And then I did the one with saxophone and bass. And so, and six-string banjo. So I decided to use that version instead, just to give the album a different flavor.
Because
as a musician that's trying to make my living, I hope I can sell some of these records. It's not like I'm completely pandering to selling records, but as it makes my living, so I also want to try to be accessible to a bigger audience,
right,
if I can be, without sacrificing the musical integrity of the music that I feel is, you know, right for me.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't get caught up in that hang-up. Like, I mean, I listen to lots of weird stuff. I mean, I listen to, like, Chinese tipa music. I listen to, you know, like, East African, you know, like, Ghanaian honk horn music with, you know, like weird folklore stuff. But that doesn't mean I have to do that on my albums. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes people get caught up in that where they, you know, like, in folk music, sometimes people get caught up in being quasi-classical, but they're not classical musicians, so they try to bring that element in there, and sometimes it works, other times it doesn't, but me, I just don't feel like doing that. I want to make sure everything I have in there, all the instrumentation is supposed to be there, and the fact that I have control on that, I'm really glad that I was able to get some really cool ideas out there without it seeming like I need to force fusion music to happen.
Right. Well, clearly, Dom, you, and we're talking to Dom Flemons, if you're just tuning in, and he has a new album out called coming out July 22nd, I think, called Prospect Hill. Dom, clearly you put a lot of thought and effort into all of those elements of this album. You know, you want to be yourself. You want to take things a little, not further, but a little different, because to say further would mean that you're leaving something behind and you're not, but you want to do some different elements in this album that people may be more used to you recently with the Chocolate Drops. So you're doing different things and you're incorporating different sounds. And like you said, you're not trying to make it, it's not going to be commercial in the sense that, you know, that you're going to be on MTV, but you want to make something that's listenable and accessible, but also true to what you're trying to do as an artist. And I really think, and I've listened to this a lot, I really think that you've done it really well.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it so much. I've been wanting to do this record. It's been about 3 years I've been really putting thought into making another record, because, you know, I did two solo records with Music Maker beforehand, Dance Tunes, Ballads, and Blues. I had that out in 2008. And in 2010, I had American Songster, where I came up American Songster, which is now a moniker I hold.
Right.
You know, I did those two records, and they were all straight acoustic, and I didn't want to have anything else on it. And I knew that coming back into the field, I really wanted to try to do something a little more expansive. So for this third record, you know, it was my first time really going for an expansive sound that wasn't with the group. And so it was really amazing to work with these wonderful musicians and to craft some really neat sounds with the different instruments. You know, like I've been listening to Georgia drum beat a couple of different times. Mm-hmm. And that was one that came, that and Grotto Beat, those two songs came together in the strangest sort of way. And I just, when I listen back to it, I'm just like, wow, that is so, who would have guessed it would have turned out like that? Yeah. But I'm pleased with it at the end of the day, you know?
And those are like both songs. What Dom is talking about, those are both songs on this Prospect Hill album. So as you listen back to it again, you're kind of even surprised or very extra pleased, we'll say, with how things came together and where they came from.
Yeah, it's just such a neat way that the instruments flow together. Like Georgia Drumbeat, I knew I wanted to have a saxophone on it. I had heard a track of Albert Collins called The Freeze, which was one of his first hits, and it has a saxophone on it, and I kind of wanted to get that sound out of that particular record on Georgia Drumbeat, you know. Then Georgia Drumbeat's a different tune altogether, so we made the beat work with that. But then when Brian started playing that saxophone solo, I mean, it was like, oh my god. And then Guy Davis, who usually doesn't play electrified harmonica, he's put down a track of, you know, and he did just a phenomenal job, you know. It was really cool to hear the way that those two instruments cross-pollinated with each other in the music. So I thought that was really cool. With Grotto Beat, I mean, I was shooting for another instrumental track. And then the guy, he felt strongly like, you need to put some words on this. So at first I was thinking like a chant, like a Love Supreme. I was thinking something like along those lines.
Yeah, all right, I get you.
But then it evolved into... evolved as we went. We had a jam in like the kitchen of the studio with the guys holding the bass drum, and we're having this jam, like, you know, marching around in a circle, just coming up with phrases. And then I came up with a few different phrases at that jam, wrote them down, and then I decided to make it almost like a kind of like primitive hip hop.
Yeah.
You know, where I
that's a great description. Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, in college, I used to cut and paste stuff like that all the time. I'd record people and cut and paste what they said into different stuff. So it was really fun to kind of put that together and craft a narrative around the different elements. And then Guy did that wonderful intro that, you know, he's like, you got to do something self-referential in this album, you know. So he put in a couple of references to me in the album, which I thought was just great. But so it was like stuff like that. I mean... In a way, I mean, those are very expansive sounding tracks, because I do like bebop, I do like jazz music, and I, even though I don't particularly play that, like, on stage, being able to pull those elements into the studio, you know, I feel that that's a really cool way to have excellent sounds with the music, but also at the same time, I don't need to feel like I have to replicate that on stage either.
No,
I hope that people would just say, oh, that's a cool record. And, you know, that's just another facet I think is very, very amazing to be able to do that.
Well, you listen to bebop and you don't have to replay it, but it becomes part of a place that you can touch. And maybe it's not ultimately obvious to everyone listening that that's where you're going, but it's part of what makes up your musical mind, if you want to think of it that way, because you do listen to it and absorb it a little bit. It may not come out as...
Sure.
Exactly,
like
on stage.
When I start playing Joe Thompson's music, you know, the part of the way I thought to play jug when I was playing like a tune like Georgia Buck, I thought of like Charles Mingus.
Yeah.
Albums like Blues and Roots, and kind of the idea of what he does with one chord, I tried to take those ideas. I even have a, you know, there's even a reference to Rashad Roland Kirk and Hot Chicken.
Okay.
Where when the saxophone solo gets all crazy. You know, I had the Brian play he came in and he was like, well, what do you want on this one? I was like, this one's called Hot Chicken. Chicken sounds. That's what I want. Chicken sounds. He was like, okay. And
did he, but did he play? Did he play four saxophones at once, though? That's what I want.
No, he didn't do four saxophones that time. We only had to bring in a little bit more a chalk for the chalkboard.
Oh man, it sounds to me like you've had a lot of fun putting this thing together, and I think you really enjoy what's out there now. I just get the feeling that you're having a good time with this new, with all the stuff that went into the new recording, and it's really good. With the things you've told me now, I'm going to go listen to it again with an ear toward those particular things I didn't catch. I've had it maybe a week or so, and you know it plays a lot, and as I listen to it, but I'll go back and pick up those little references that you're
wonderful.
Talking about. But
wonderful.
Great album. You know, if I had to describe Dom Lemons, I'm sorry. I'm looking right at your name. I missed the first part. I would say to try to relate your influences and things that influence you and what you search for. If there were a living, breathing, still learning compilation of the Alan Lomax Field recordings, still growing, breathing version, that would almost be you in the concept. Not that those songs necessarily, but you gather all this music from wherever you go, and you learn it and you absorb it, and then you reinterpret it. That's a pretty fair statement, don't you think?
Oh man, that's an awesome statement. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
I mean, you know, in old, I've heard you refer to it as old time, and that's a broad stroke. But you find, I mean, you're playing quills. You're playing bones, and it's not like you're just like going to Walgreens and buying. You're playing bones that are like the bones that the guys that you mentioned were playing. And I mean, you really source this stuff out and try to make it original, but then you reinterpret what you've learned. You're not just mimicking songs and sounds. You're using those instruments with all that music inside of you and using those instruments to reinterpret.
Well, it's funny you mention Alan Lomax. You know, at one point, Mike Seeger and Alan Lomax are two people that I'm very indebted to. Mike for the actual idea of blending old-time music ideas together. And I took it kind of one step farther when I was just, because no one was paying attention to what I was doing at that point. I took it one step farther, and I would take even like pop tunes I knew, like songs like Maybe After He's Gone by the Zombies, and make a banjo version of that, you know, or Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard. You know, I'd think to do that. But then I got in, after I came to North Carolina, I got into choreometrics and got into reading Alan Lomax's study of choreometrics. I couldn't get through it all. It was very dense.
I don't know what that is, but I appreciate what you're saying.
During the last 25 years of his life, Alan Lomax, who was a statistician by trade, you know, that was his actual degree.
Oh.
He used key card computers to try to categorize the music of the world's people in a very statistical way to show a line of musical evolution. And he pretty much made the Bering Strait thing, like with his musical evolution based on certain criteria that traditional types of music had.
Okay.
So, as you can imagine, written out, this is very dense.
Yeah.
He pretty much invented what we now know as Pandora. That's the global jukebox.
Okay, yeah, okay.
He created the global jukebox so you could put in a gajillion pieces of film footage or audio, and the machine itself would make a variable that randomly showed you something that would be related to this other thing based on the statistics of, you know, whatever the criteria that they have of it. So Pandora does the same thing.
Okay.
You pick Bob Dylan, you're probably going to get Joan Baez, Phil Oaks, or Tom Paxton, or something
gotcha.
Like that.
Gotcha. Okay.
I recommend that to you.
Okay. All right. So
every once in a while they'll say Papa Charlie Jackson, you know, which is, Dylan's never particularly mentioned Papa Charlie, but through Charlie Patton and a couple other guys, you can get sort of like a, you can get like this kind of weird stone's throw onto something new just because certain criteria match. And so like Alan Lomax created a system like that. And the choreometrics part of it was based on the idea that when you see someone dancing a traditional dance correctly, it is the ultimate representation of that folk culture because the audience and the performer know that the criteria are all there and are correct. And people don't have to say anything. They just know. They say, you know, like if you hear someone sing a gospel number and it's just right, the first note, everybody knows this person's already going to kill it the whole time.
Okay.
You know, okay. And so that was the idea. So for me, I got into studying the music, and I tried my best to take certain aspects of the music and, you know, try to interpret that when I'm performing it on stage, make references that, you know, I don't have to particularly explicitly explain, but they symbolize something for somebody or whoever my audience is.
Right. Yeah, and a big part of, and I assume you still do it if you're even on a solo tour, is that you weave a little bit of the history into what you're doing, not to where it becomes a college course, but that you do put some references in there and kind of like, you know, markers as you go. You might explain the influence or maybe the author or why you're doing a particular song, but you still do that, I assume, even though you're by yourself, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, that goes back to when I was 18 years old. On October the 12th, in 2001, I went to a concert of Dave Van Ronk, and he passed away the following February, but I caught him in Phoenix, Arizona, and I saw him. I had been playing like folk music and rock and pop, but then when I saw Dave's show, the format that he had where he performed a song and then he told an anecdote, didn't matter if it was a historical, it could be a personal story, it could be any sort of anecdote that makes the song more interesting. And I really latched onto that idea, and I've done that ever since. Like it also, as a performer, gives you a break. You can talk to the audience. You can take a second and get into the next song.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was great, you know, because sometimes, you know, when a band plays just a straight 90 minutes all the way through, that's cool. But I always like it when someone says something, because, I don't know, if I'm a fan of music, I go to the show, I've heard the record, obviously.
Right.
And it's always cool when even if the artist says, you know, one time I was drunk when I wrote this, you know, and then, hey, you know, that's cool. I didn't know he was drunk when he wrote that. It sounds like it. Oh, you know.
Just a little
those
something.
Are the sort of,
yeah, just a little,
you know,
something extra.
Sort of things I like.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like I remember one time, I used to tell people a lot when I would do the throat thing, you know, Don't Get Shovel in Your Mind. I'd tell them that I learned how to do that from watching the movie Genghis Blues. And I remember a few years back, a guy came up to me like, when I was at a festival, I was like at the concession stand. And he's like, hey, man, I like your show. I said, thanks. He's like, you know, I got into throat singing because you mentioned Genghis Blues, and I totally looked it up, and what an awesome movie. And I said, oh, man, that's great. And, you know, me, I'm a fan of that movie. So we had a connection because we had a shared like of a certain piece of music and a certain piece of art. So it was really kind of, it's cool to do that as well, instead of it just being, you know, when you're a singer-songwriter, it's all about, you know, people write self-referential stuff, so all about me and my emotions all the time, and I'm not really that sort of person to say, I want to talk about me all the time, so I like telling stories, and true stories, too, you know, which is, I think it's a nice change of pace, because, I don't know, history has some wacky events to it, and when you say something that's really outrageous to people, and then they find out it's completely true, it blows their mind.
Well, and like, you know? when you mentioned this guy said, hey, I got into this music because of your reference, well, see, then he can tell someone else about it. And so you can kind of keep that a living thing, because they may not all be recorded as such, and maybe there was a movie with some of that in it, but you keep it alive by word of mouth, which is really how recordings are not in the field or whether in a studio. What really keeps it alive is the live performance aspect of it and the communication, either through the music or the stories that you tell.
Absolutely. You know, that's why I always try to talk directly to my audience, too, instead of trying to create a fourth wall all the time.
Yeah.
Because I think it's really important that people see that the performers on stage don't have to be these high and mighty performers, that they themselves can be at least as good of a musician, and they can, you know, that they can do stuff themselves as well. You know, it's like, well, you know, that's what I always liked about Pete Seeger. You know, it's always was a, well, heck, you like that, what I'm doing, shit, go do it yourself.
That's right.
You probably got something cool in your background as well, because, you know, that's the thing, we're taught in America that, you know, oh, we have a horrible culture, but it's, you know, most people have at least one generation or two generations back something completely awesome in their background. Something, a tradition, it doesn't have to be a big thing, but it's something that's just unique in itself. You know, and that's, for me, that's, it's all about creating awareness about stuff like that.
And the thing about it too, Dom, is that they don't have to be performers. They just do it, and maybe they do it in their house, or maybe they do it, play with music with neighbors, and that tradition lives. But they don't have to take it to the level. Maybe they don't want to perform. You know, it's not necessary.
Absolutely.
But it's just playing the music and keeping it alive and vital, I think. It's my interpretation.
Totally. And then for me also, just to, you know, bring different schools of thought together. I feel like in the 21st century, there's a lot of documentation that's out there and schools of thought that I feel overlap, but I don't think that they've ever actively been, you know, they have actively been talked about as a complete picture. And so trying to do that with jazz and string band music and blues and jug band music, all those sort of ideas are things that when I first heard, that's what drew me to North Carolina. When I first heard that string band music, I heard, like, hey, now, this is the same sort of stuff I'm hearing when Lead Belly's playing guitar.
Exactly.
Or, like, Charlie Patton,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so then, like, the Mississippi Sheiks, when you find out that Charlie Patton's within the family of the Mississippi Sheiks and stuff like that, you start seeing patterns that, you know, blues scholars didn't particularly pick up on. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that it's any worse that they didn't pick up on it. But now, with the new knowledge, you can do something different with it.
Dom, do you find yourself kind of pulling threads, that you find this thing and you just kind of pull this thread and see where it goes? And like you say, you wind up from here to there to the Mississippi Sheiks. Do you feel like that's part of what keeps you interested, is that you just keep pulling these little threads and finding different paths?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when every time you think you've found everything that you can find on something, there's always some extra detail that opens every door again, and then you're at the beginning again.
Yeah.
But that's what's part of what's interesting in the ride. I mean, even like, for example, like, let's say, like, I'll mention Bob Dylan again. Like, when I got the new bootleg series, I've never been a fan of the album Self-Portrait, but when I heard all these new demos they put out of him and David Bromberg just playing without all the backing tracks, I mean, it's pretty brilliant, but that's something I never heard. And I've been a pretty avid fan for a while, and had tons of bootlegs, but for whatever reason, that was always under wraps, you know. And it's like that for anything. I mean, it can go back to, I don't know, any time, like the late 1800s. All of a sudden, someone just, you know, they take a piece of paper out of a bookshelf and it's like, oh, look at this. This is from 1885. You know. And it's a very important letter talking about such and such and whatever it is. I mean, it keeps going no matter what. There's always more.
It shows. I'll tell you this, man. It shows in the music that you pursue, and then you perform and recreate, that you're just always searching for that, which I think keeps my attraction to you in the music, is that it's always sort of like really fresh to you in your mind, and you're always intrigued about the next step. That's what I get from your music and seeing you perform, is that you're looking for the next place to enrich yourself, and then also reconvey that back out to an audience, whether it's a recording, or I would strongly recommend always people go to live performances, because that's the real thing. But I think it shows so much, Dom, in what you're doing, and I really appreciate what you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much. And, you know, it's also with it too, keep throwing all this other stuff we've talked about out of the way. The music needs to speak.
Right.
I feel like on this album also, I feel like I got all of my ideas across while the music really speaks for itself before you have to even think about that other stuff.
Yeah.
It's just like, I feel like I tried to make it so it just washes over you, and you get a lot of history and a lot of different sounds and styles without having to think too hard about it. And it's like, that's the thing that I think is very important too. It's what makes the music not just precious, artifacts to me, is when you're really making the music. You know, you have to get your audience to feel what that music is. You can't just say this is soul stirring. It has to be soul stirring, you know.
Yeah.
And I see, you know, that's how some of all my favorite recordings all are. Is they moved me, you know. Yeah.
And you don't want to beat somebody over the head with what you're, you know, say, look at what I'm doing and I'm doing it now. You just want to do it and let them experience.
Yeah. And see, I can talk about all this stuff all day, but, you know, in the end, just play the record and hope that I did my job.
That's right. Well, I think in Prospect Hill, I have the release date being July 22nd. So you're out now. Letting people know that's coming, and that's great. I'm going to catch you somewhere along the road when you're out there. I have one, and Dom, I hope that we've kind of circled around and covered things that are important to you in this interview, because I really wanted to make sure that I gave you the opportunity. And I think we've kind of circled around enough to cover things that if I'd done it in a straight line, we would have done it, but I don't do things that way. I just kind of like see where things are going. So I think we've covered a lot of your influence. We could talk a long time about specific things, but I think now the audience gets a pretty good picture, I hope you agree, with what Dom Flemons is doing and his influences and the music that he's bringing today. I think so.
Hey, man, I appreciate you, Steve. Thank you so much. And, you know, I'm excited to get out there to Cincinnati. And I've actually been playing a lot in the Midwest this year, so I've been really enjoying that. You know, and also there's a great new record for the people out there listening called, what is it called? They play it like you did back to George Street. Play it like you did back to George Street, which is an anthology of Cincinnati blues.
Oh, cool.
And it is just a fantastic double record.
Good.
And, you know, always keeping out for something new.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I appreciate it. I hope that we've, like I said, I hope we've weaved in enough of the information you wanted to get out, the new album. They can go to your website and find out where you're going to be. That's easy enough. Here's a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, here's a thing too. I want to ask you specifically. I want to get ready for one of these things. YouTube is so available now, and there's so many neat things you have on. You have your own. I think I subscribed to something that you put up. But here's the one I want to ask you about. This will be the last thing I ask you specifically. The song on the headlights of the car. I just want to know what made you stop the car and get out and record a video of you playing in front of the headlights.
Well, you know, Tom Chaburi, who is the fellow who shot that one, he shot that, Country Girl, Can You Blame the Colored Man, and several things from Music Maker. Tom's a funny sort of guy. We were shooting videos all that day, and that old truck there, it broke down halfway between Hillsboro and Durham, which is really the middle of nowhere. And so we were worried about it, but then we were able to start the truck. We got it going a little more. Mind you, this is like 12:30 at night too. We're both like tired after this shoot, and so then the truck broke down again. And we just liked that was the thing. All those videos from that series were just made to be single shots of really dynamic looking backgrounds, and so we just saw that. Those lights, and it was like, oh yeah, let's do this. And you know, it was in the middle of the night, like 1:30 in the morning, and so we knew we only had one take to get it, so we did that one take, and the cops came.
Yeah, I was gonna say you only had one take. That was good.
that was actually what happened.
Oh, really?
The cops came and we're like, hey boys, how are you doing? And we're like, oh, we're doing fine. And you know, by that time we had our one take, so
just
so then we packed it up and said, oh, no more noise.
Just shooting a video here.
Yeah. So I mean, it was just stuff like that. It was just kind of a spur of the moment. Okay. Like, oh, this is cool looking lights, you know. I think it looked like Friday the 13th. That's what I was
thinking. A little bit. I kept looking. Yeah, exactly right. I kept looking. Look out over your shoulder, Dom. There's somebody coming. It's good. I like it. Oh, man. I've enjoyed this so much. I'm going to let you get back. I know you're busy. I know you're at a function there, and you kind of ducked out for a minute. And I appreciate you being available and what you're doing on the stage and on recordings. It's right in my wheelhouse. I love what you're doing. I love the references and the allusions and the music that you do, and just keep doing it, man. It works so well.
Oh, thank you so much.
Right.
I appreciate it, Steve. And man, it's a pleasure to talk with you. And
good.
Hopefully we'll talk again next time around.
We'll do that. And hold on. I'm going to stop the recording. I want you to hold on for 1 second. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That was a, I'll say, a 50-minute glimpse into the artist that is Dom Flemons. And honestly, it was just a snapshot. We covered a lot of ground. There's a lot more. As you can tell, there's all little eddies floating around that if we had a time, we could have explored all those things that Dom brings into his music, his influences, and his performances. And I just really enjoy everything that he's doing. It makes sense to me. Hopefully it makes sense to you. So there was about 52 minutes of Dom Flemons standing outside of a meeting that he was with. And we wound up going for a long time. If you listen to this show at all, or if you go to unrealbluegrass.com and you pick up, there's maybe 100, I don't know how many there are, maybe 130 interviews that we've put up for you to listen to. Some are 20 minutes, some are 50, some are an hour and 10. The question that I get when I contact an artist and we finally hook up and they say, how long are we going to do this? My answer is, I don't know. It takes until it's finished. And there's usually sort of an organic process that takes place, and we kind of know when it's going to end. That seemed to end at 52 minutes. Sometimes they end in 10 minutes. I don't really time them, which is a luxury that I have. I recognize that on this type of a format and this type of a programming opportunity for me and for the guests. So, and I think some artists are a little bit reluctant to be that open-ended because they might be more used to the hi, I'm a radio station and the talking points, which I don't use at all. I really don't use. I never have. We just kind of go where it goes. And I felt very comfortable that Dom would take us exactly where we needed to be. And I enjoyed every minute of it, man. I'm going to catch him next Friday up in Walton, Kentucky, Stevenson's Tavern and Grill. And I'm going to have a good time doing that. And I will catch up to Dom again later down the road. Thanks so much for stopping by and making yourself available so we could have a nice discussion.